can't really think. Probably the first memory. I went to Holy Family School in Newington, and they used to have a Christmas play, like, you know, and it wasn't me, but my brother Seamus. He was in the school play, and he had a sailor's uniform.
Okay,
you know, like a wee white uniform, like, you know. Yeah. And he was in a play, and he had a song, and I mean that just sticks with me now. There was a song, and that song become his song.
Wow.
And like when we had a party in the house, say my mom or dad or, you know, someone's birthday relatives was around or there was just a sing song on, everyone had to sing a song.
And that was his?
That was his song, but I had a song, was Stew Ball Was a Racehorse. I couldn't tell you now, but that was, yeah, so that was the first memory, was him singing in that school. And he was a year younger than me, like, you know.
So,
that was the first real memory sort of thing. Like,
that's, you know, cool.
I can't remember really from Holy Family. I went on to then Barnegiga sort of thing. And then that was, you know, sort of different age, like, you know. But I remember plenty about Barney, but not so much going back in the younger days, like, you know.
Absolutely, yeah. I was chatting to someone recently about how, you know, back really before TVs were like what they are today in the house, you know, people would stand up and they would recite wee poems and they would tell wee stories and they would sing songs. And it's funny, like all that has started to kind of really start to fade away. But it used to be such a big part of, yeah, of course, Belfast culture. But I think families everywhere, you know.
Well, to me, I would say there was a time before and then a time. There was a time before Apple and a time after Apple.
That's a good way to put it, yeah.
You know, and before you do things, I think ours was the last sort of generation of people, you know, we've done things the way my man and dad done things.
Yeah.
And nowadays, you know, kids just don't do it. Like, you know, there's just things have changed. Things are always going to change. I know that.
Yeah.
But it's just different now to just some, all the old traditions and things, you know, kids don't play in the street anymore.
Yeah, that's totally true. Yeah.
You know, it's changed, you know, just walking around Belfast. We haven't been, it's good while since we've been back in Belfast, and just, you see all the, everything changes. I suppose that's just life, like, you know.
It is, yeah, totally. So, if you've just jumped on to listen, hello and welcome. Welcome to Best of Belfast. We are the podcast that celebrates Northern Ireland and the incredible people in it. Joined today, you've been hearing already, from Leonard Nugent. A wee bit about Leonard. Leonard is a businessman and now an author. That's pretty cool, isn't it?
Yeah.
And an author from New Lodge in Belfast with really an incredible story to tell. So a wee bit of that, a wee overview for you, just before we kind of jump in and hear from Leonard himself. Despite experiencing homelessness at a young age and receiving no formal education, Leonard went on to start a one-man construction business that has now become a multi-million pound company. He's also a big fan of some adventures. I can't wait to hear some of these. You sailed across the Atlantic, you walked the Camino, and you're about to start a 2,500 kilometre walk from Malin Head to Cork. Wow, fair play to you. Both his adventures and his latest memoir, Keeper Lit, has really been driven by the desire to inspire young people who are just starting out in the world, and it's also to try and raise money for the Open House Homeless Charity. And so, Leonard, really simply, I mean, there's so much to talk about. Your life has been far-reaching and varied, and it sounds like you've got a really class story to tell. But I'd love to just kind of start in the beginning. You know, what was it like growing up in New Lodge? You talk about how Belfast has changed. What was all that like?
Well, we wasn't from the New Lodges. We was from the Antrim Road and just off Skegnig Avenue. And but all the family was from the New Lodge, and we used to play down there as kids and that there. But yeah, in them days, I suppose, it was really before the Troubles.
Mm.
And, you know, I sort of talk about it in the book. It was Catholics and Protestants playing together. There was no, you know, there was no problems or anything. Like, you know, we had Protestant friends. It was just, there wasn't a, it was no big deal then, like, you know, the 12th of July, we'd go out and watch the bands everything, you know, it was grand. It wasn't a problem at all. Yeah, after a few years, it did sort of change, like, you know. Where we lived, Queen Victoria Gardens, there was only two or three Catholic families there, and over a time, everyone had to leave, like, you know.
Yeah.
My dad at that time, he had problems you know, finding work, you know, as a Catholic in them times. It was just, that's the way it was, I suppose. He went over to England and used to send money back to my ma.
Wow.
And I suppose, you know, we were sort of growing up in here. My dad was over there. And then after a few incidents sort of happened around where we lived, it was decided, look, we were getting to an age then where you started getting involved in things that, sure, you shouldn't, yeah, have done. So my dad come back and he took us over to England, like, you know, we moved to England, like, you know.
Yeah, crazy. It's crazy even to hear, like, you know, so I'm 25, so when was I born? Born in 95. It's crazy to even hear you say a phrase like before the Troubles. Because I never knew the Northern Ireland before the Troubles, do you know what I mean? I've only actually ever known Northern Ireland after the Troubles, so I didn't even know during. But I assume yous were definitely playing out the streets then. Yous weren't on the screens back then.
yeah, but we'd play in the street, and everyone would all play together. There was never, you know, any issues or any thoughts. Okay, there's some pavements would be, you'd see red, white, and blue on the curbs, yeah, and that, sure, there, like, you know, and then you go over to maybe the New Lords or the Falls or whatever, and you'd see there'd be tricolours there, and so you knew the difference of where, yeah, which areas and that there, but I don't remember any, as young kids, too much problems, like, you know.
That's interesting.
I think later on, as I sort of got a bit older, when I was going to Barney and school there, we used to meet off school, and that was when, you know, the rioting was going on, and we used to go down, and it was a good crack, actually, you know. We used to hop on the back of wagons from, you know, bottom of Divis Street, and maybe go, well, we'd go to where the police stations was, because there was sleeping policemen in front of the police stations then. And we'd go onto the back of wagons. You don't see that happening now, but you cling onto the back of a wagon and you'd go up and down, you know, the Crumlin Road or the Falls Road or the Antrim Road, whatever.
Yeah.
And just do that all day long, up and down on the back of wagons, which is crazy now when you think about it, you know.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of stuff going on, and, you know, you sort of seen it, like, you know, and you need to keep away from it as much as you could, sort of thing, like, you know. But, yeah, I think growing up in Belfast, it also, it made you a bit streetwise, and you sort of had an instinct then as well about where not to go, what to do, you know, what streets to keep away from, and
absolutely,
things like that. There,
and
like,
that, you know, that does stay with you, and it's quite a useful thing to have, you know, especially as you travel and stuff, as you have.
We do a hell of a lot of traveling, myself and Mary, and that Belfast thing is always in the back of my head. I've always got that, I call it a get out of jail card. you have it's an instinct, I suppose.
Yeah.
And it's helped me many times, like, you know.
That's awesome. So, like, what about school, and, you know, what about kind of like those earlier teen years? Like, did you enjoy school? Was there any part of school that you liked? Any part of school you were good at?
Nothing. Maybe PE. You know, it was one time there was, we used to all just mitch off school, like, you know. And one time I remember my ma getting on the bus in the Antrim Road. She seen me about 11 o'clock on a bus and trailed me off the bus, like, you know, in front of everyone. But no, I never enjoyed it, went. I mean, years later, I sort of self-educated myself. And I think education is brilliant.
Yeah.
The first exam I ever took in my life was when I was 50, and it was
incredible.
Maltese. I went to night school in Malta to learn Maltese, and it's an Arabic based language.
Yeah.
And the guy's trying to teach me about verbs and nouns. I hadn't got a clue.
Absolutely,
what you're talking about. But I learned, and I was there for 3 years, and I passed all them exams, and that was the first exams I ever took, was learning Maltese, sort of thing, like, you know.
Incredible. And so, like, would you have been tactile as a young guy? Like, would you have been building things? Would you have been using your hands? What I'm trying to get at, like, you know, was the construction in you?
No, it wasn't construction in me. I was always looking to earn money.
Yeah, it was the money side, yeah.
As a young kid around Belfast, I used to milk round, a paper round, mm. lemonade round, anything that was going.
Any rounds going.
anything at all, like, you know, to earn a pound, that was me, I was there, like, you know. Yeah. And, you know, as a young boy, before I went to school, I'd maybe do two paper rounds.
Yeah.
And if any, and I worked for Billy Duddy, had a shop in Glendore Avenue. And if any kids didn't come in, he always used to come across and knock on our door.
Yeah.
Could I go and do the rounds? So I knew everyone's round because I never missed a day, but other kids would miss
you
times.
You would fill in for theirs as well, yeah.
Yeah, so I knew all the rounds in the morning and the night. So what I'd do every night, like after I'd done my rounds, I'd go round to the. I knew which letterboxes you couldn't get that. Say that the telly, you couldn't get the
That's
papers
class.
In.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I'd go and I'd take the papers out of the ones I knew they couldn't get the papers into. Like
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
And I used to flog them round the pubs, like you know, like around different. And I'd done that for years. No, and I wouldn't hit one round. I'd do one round one night. Someone's round a different. I'd move it around so that no one ever knew it was me. That
yeah,
was
yeah, yeah.
Pulling them out, like you know. Yeah. But yeah, that was. It was always that whatever I could earn a pound at.
Mm-hmm.
I was there, like you know, whatever yeah. it was, the lemonade man. That many.
Yeah.
Things like that many small jobs. Like,
so you know. Then, did you before the business? What type of work did you do? Or was it always stuff like that?
Oh no, well, it always worked. My dad worked in construction in London and in Sussex, Crawley in Sussex.
Yeah.
And we sort of followed him into it, like, you know.
Awesome.
Yeah, that always sort of worked in construction, really, I suppose.
Cool. So why did you decide to then start your own business and how did that kind of happen?
Well, I seen what sort of money the guys that I was working for, I got approached to become a foreman of this company. It was an Irish company from the south and in London. They were the biggest sort of groundwork contractors in London. They asked me to become, I become a foreman for them. And there was a surveyor who used to come round every week doing his measurements. And I wanted to know what was the good bits, what was where was the money? And,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
how were we earning money for this guy? And where was he losing money in that? Yeah. I was interested in that. And from that there, I sort of decided, well, if that I'm making this guy money, I'm going to start doing it for myself.
Yeah,
like,
absolutely,
you know?
Yeah.
So I sort of learned, you know, bits of sort of quantity surveying and how these guys really made their money and where to focus in on where you could lose money, I suppose.
Yeah.
So I suppose that was it. Like, you know, just that's how I sort of started going to start my own business. I thought, well, I'm making the man money. I might as well go and do it for myself.
Absolutely,
like,
yeah. No, I mean, that's totally true. That's why companies have employees, isn't it?
That's why they what?
Why companies have employees to make
well,
the money.
Yeah, I mean, in our company now, we train our guys. It's unbelievable the training that we do. Like, you know, I've always believed in it and teaching people. And I think if you should never be as scared to pass on information or pass on knowledge. There's a lot of people who are, you know, they think holding on to that knowledge is they've got some sort of power. But I've always believed, and I've taught it to all our managers, like, you know, teach people, you know, bring people on within the business. I hate in bringing outsiders like agency guys into the business. We all are the foremen, contract managers, directors. They've all started pretty much as laborers in the business.
Yeah, that's
right. Right through our whole business now, it's everyone is pretty much started on a shovel on a building site and come up. We sort of try and identify. Look, and we're always looking for the talent, and you don't need to. You just got to have the right attitude. If someone's got the right attitude, we'll sort of teach them and put. To bring them on different training courses and things like that there.
Yeah, that's awesome. You have a real passion for homelessness and for the homeless. Where does that come from?
Well, yeah, what happened was, years ago, I was working with my dad on building the Hilton Hotel at Gatwick Airport. Mm. And I had a ride with him one day. Well, that wasn't unusual, like, you know.
Yeah.
And on the Friday, I got weighed in. I got paid, and it was about £80 in them days. I was on the airport. So as soon as I got my money, I had it planned, like, you know, I had a rucksack,
yeah,
just with some pairs of underpants and shirts and whatever.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I went to work that day, and as soon as I got weighed in with the money, I went over and I bought a ticket straight to Dublin, and I thought it would be, I'd get work over there no problem at all, like, you know.
Yeah.
And the £80 lasted me about two nights. You know, you went for a beer and whatever, and the £80 was gone.
Yep.
I thought I'd have a job Monday morning. It wasn't a problem. And that wasn't the case. In them days, I suppose that would have been late, mid-70s, or late 70s, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
The unions run Dublin, like, you know, all the construction. And if you wasn't in the union, you had no chance of getting a job. But even then, you had to know someone. And I was there, I didn't know anyone. So I ended up walking around Dublin for weeks, you know. Well, we ended up in dormitories, but that was, it was a bit dangerous, actually, after a while. And I preferred, I ended up just keeping where I could keep, like, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Stealing a bit of, you know, I used to go into supermarkets and take what I could take.
Yeah.
You know, around taking bottles. You don't get milk rounds now, but then there was people would leave the bottles of milk outside, and you would go and take milk and whatever, like, you know. But always stayed with me. When I see homeless people now, you know, kipping in the street and that there, you don't know what story's behind that guy, like, you know. And there could be successful people there, and they find themselves on the street for any amount of reasons.
Absolutely.
Like, you know. And they're not, you know, people look at them and they think, oh, they're junkies, or they've got a drink problem. And some of these people are, you speak to them, intelligent people, you know, that have just come across, you know, a bad luck or whatever, like, you know.
Yeah.
So I've always had a empathy for them, sort of thing, like, you know.
Totally.
And when we decided to write the book, I said, well, look, I don't need the money from the book. We'll dedicate it.
Yeah.
You know, whatever the proceeds we get from the book will go straight to the homeless, like, you know.
Yeah.
That homeless charity in Sussex there, we've done a fair bit of work for them, building, they have a place in Crawley there. We helped them years ago. We helped them as much as we can anyway, but we built some toilets there, and they put some places where they put beds and everything in there now, like, you know. So hopefully the money we raise now from the book and from this walk that we're going to do will all, you know, it'll all help, like, you know.
Yeah. So before we kind of get on to, you know, how you wrote the book and why you wrote the book, I'd love just to hear a wee bit more about, you know, because there's a class line where, you know, you started with a wheelbarrow and that was your business, and then you've built it up into what it is today. You know, when did you start that business, and what were some of the challenges along the way?
Well, when I started the business at first, it was just myself, literally, in a wheelbarrow, and I had enough money to buy an old escort van, something like that there,
nice,
like, you know. And then I used to just go and knock on people's doors for, you know, to build a driveway for them, or a patio or something like that there.
Yeah.
And what happened was, my ma used to work, she was a cleaner for a guy called Eddie McMillan. He had an airline out of Gatwick that used to move, all he'd done was move race courses.
Oh, wow.
Race horses around the world. And my ma cleaned his offices. So when my ma was cleaning the offices, I had a load of flyers printed out. And my dad just used to stay at the printing machine for 2 or 3 hours every night while she was cleaning, printing out these leaflets for me.
And, that's brilliant.
Yeah. So, and then what I'd do then every night after work, I'd go, me and my wife would take one side of the street, she'd be pushing a pram, going through, putting leaflets through the doors, and I'd do the other side of the street, just hopping over fences, sticking the leaflets through the doors.
Yeah.
And I'd done that for months and months, like, you know, and you couldn't go to bed until whatever. So if my dad printed off 300-400,
yeah.
300-400, you had to get rid of. We never went home until every leaflet was through.
Your paper round days, or were paying dividends there?
I'm not joking. Yeah, sometimes it was 12, 1, 2 o'clock in the morning. You were putting leaflets through doors, and then you're up at 7 o'clock. To go out to work, she would do the phone during the day. Anyone phoned up, they got the leaflet and wanted a price or whatever.
Yeah.
So, and through that there, we just built up the business,
Wow.
And we never had to advertise. Once the leaflets got round, people always done a good job, try to give people what they were paying for.
Yeah.
And they told their friend, and it was word of mouth. The business just grew, and we didn't need to sort of advertise or whatever,
That's unreal.
So we sort of built the business that way,
Yeah, crazy. Yeah. That's literally amazing. I love that kind of scene of her with the pram, especially. That's gas.
Yeah, there was many times there. As the business, that was that sort of, that was all cash. All that business was cash, and it was great. Yeah. And it got to a point where, hang on a minute, I didn't want to put stuff in the bank or anything. And you think, I found all sorts of places to hide money, And I knew if I was going to be, I always had dreams I thought, what's stopping me? I've always believed any person can do, if you want to do something, you'll do it.
Yeah.
No one ever stopped me, and no one ever will stop me doing anything. If I put my mind to something, I've always achieved it. I always give myself, say a New Year's resolution.
Yeah.
But by Paddy's Day, I'd done it. And after a while, it just got silly because I just knew I'd focus on it, whatever it was, whatever the resolution was. I want to do this. I want to do that. I'd done it, and I'd done it dead easy. And I know now I'm 60, and if I wanted to be an astronaut, that's probably out of the question.
Yeah, sure.
But anything else, if I put my mind to it, I'll do it. And I've never failed yet. Just people just need to apply themselves and forget everything else and focus on it. And everything I ever said I'm going to do, I've done it.
Yeah.
Just by focusing and hard work, I suppose, just getting on and doing it,
So where do you think that self-belief and that drive came from?
I think from my mom and dad, they wouldn't let you... there was no one laying in bed in our house. If you wasn't, you had to be working. Once we left school, we all worked when we were at school, different jobs, as I said. But then once you left school, you had to bring your money in and throw it on the table every week, And if you didn't, you're out the door. It's as simple as that. My dad had it, a work ethic built into all of us, And thank God we've all got it till today, I don't know whether that's a Belfast thing or whether that's, we were all grafters, and we knew the only way we were going to get on in life was by working. Mm. We never done the lottery or anything.
Yeah.
My dad would do a bet, and I remember one time he said to me, he asked me to write out a betting slip. I didn't know how. I'd never been in a bookies in my life. I never knew how to write a betting slip, and he said to me, "You'll never make a gambler." And I said, "Fuck me!" I said, "If he knew half the gambles, half the things that I was doing, he'd have never said that there." And I suppose that was part of the reason with the book as well. I wanted him to see. He never knew some of the stories behind. He never knew the gambles I was actually taking. There was one time there. Maggie Thatcher brought in a right to buy in England. I don't think, did they have that in Belfast?
I couldn't tell you, I'll be honest. Not sure.
Anyway, through right to buy, we always had council houses. No one ever had their own house, And she brought this, my mum and dad had rented this house for, I suppose, 20 years then. And she brought this thing in, you could... if you've been in the house for so long, you could buy it and you got a big discount, So I bought the house, but over the years, only me and my dad knew, I sold the house about 5 or 6 times. I didn't sell it. I used it as security.
Yeah.
So, and many times my dad said to me, what's happening? Like, you know, I said, here, sign that there. And he had signed it. He knew what so I wanted to use that there with the bank as collateral, security. And he was glad, and I was glad when I got it paid off, sort of thing. But I'd done that touch three or four times with that house. The house was you know, used as secure. But I always got it back. It was never a problem. Yeah. But my man never knew. But he sort of knew them gambles I was taking, like, you know. And you knew it's your man, dad's house. You're not going to lose. You can't, you know, whatever you needed to do, you'd done it to make sure it was paid off, like, you know.
Yeah. So how do you go from, you know, not being able to write a gambling slip to writing a book? Tell me about that process. Because, you know, writing a book is it's a real mammoth of a task, you know, for anybody, even if they're like mad keen writers, they'll tell you it's really, really hard to get it done.
Well, I don't even know where to start, but what we moved to Florida in December last year. We built a house there, and we moved in, I think it was on the 16th of December, and I'd always said I wanted to write a book at some time, because, as I say, there was things I wanted to tell my dad, different stories. He died, literally, we were sailing across the Atlantic. I missed that bit, but we was sailing from, we left Malta on the 29th of October to sail across the Atlantic. We got as far as Gibraltar, and it took us 9 or 10 weeks to get there, which should have been a 2 or 3 week trip, like, you know. But we got battered by storms. Like, the boat got battered. Wow. Me and Mary got battered. I broke 3 ribs in one of the storms. I ended up in hospital.
Flippy, you did get battered?
Oh, yeah. Jesus Christ. You know. And we eventually got the boat into Almeriemar. And I had no internet or phone.
Yeah.
And we got in there, and I spoke the phone my sister up, Maria, and she said, look, my dad's in a bad way in hospital. And I said, that was just, an excuse that I was looking for. I said, I'll be back there tomorrow.
Yeah.
So I got the boat into a marina, and we got a flight the next day to Gatwick, and went straight to the airport to see my dad. And I just seen him, and the nurse, seen him that day, and then we went home that night, and I knew it wasn't going to be long, like, you know.
Yeah.
And then during the night, my sister phoned me, and she says, listen, they want someone to go up in the hospital tomorrow morning. I was the oldest boy, like, you know.
Yeah.
So I was going up there anyway. We went to the hospital, and the nurse said to me, listen, this is not good. I said, well, I know, I can work that out. What, what's the crack, like, you know? She goes, well, he hasn't got long. I said, okay, how long? And she goes, well, I can't tell you. I said, well, what, hours, days? She goes, well, if I was you, I'd get your family up now, like, you know. So I said, okay. She goes, look, I have to tell Mr. Nugent, like, you know. I said, okay, let's go on. So my dad couldn't speak at that. You know, he was all tubes and he couldn't speak, but he could blink his eyes, like, you know. And she started to explain. And she said, is that all? I said, this grand. And she went away, and I said to him, did you get what she's saying? And he just looked at me. I said, look, blink twice if you understand what she just told you.
Yeah.
You know, this is it now. You've got maybe a day or two left, like, you know. And he blinked, like, you know, you welled up, sort of thing. I said, Jesus Christ. And I phoned everyone and said, look, come up that night. So I had, people was at work and whatever. And so I had the rest of the day with him, and we had a good crack talking. I'm doing the talking, and he's blinking and sort of smiling and blah, blah, blah. And I sort of said my goodbyes to him then. And it was then I was saying, well, I wish I had wrote that book before. I'm getting back to this, why I sort of wrote the book, because there was so much. My dad helped me with the business, and, you know, always good with advice and different things. And he never actually got to, you know, to see the bloody book, like, you know.
Yeah.
So I said, well, when he's in America, then the virus come in, everything was locked down and out there. And I said, well, I'm not going to sit here doing nothing. Let's see how I start writing this book.
Absolutely.
So I just, you know, got the laptop out and started from there, sort of thing, like, you know.
Yeah. Did you find it easier to write it, like write the first draft of it, or did you find it easier to go back and edit it? Because some people find it different bits easier.
No, to be honest, I'll tell you what happened. I didn't know what to do, and I went on to Google. And yeah. I mean, I'd never written a book or anything else. I'd done some writings for, as a company, we'd won loads of awards for training.
Nice.
And I was at Sussex Enterprise, and different people like that had approached me to write bits, articles and that there for about the awards that we'd done and, you know, what training we were doing. So I had a little bit of knowledge of writing a little bit, but as I said, I'd never taken any exams or anything. And when we was in America, I Googled and how do you write a book?
Yeah.
And I couldn't find nothing. And I found a company in Los Angeles. And I contacted them, and they said, well, look, we'll put you in contact with a guy who – you give him the story and he'll write it.
Brilliant.
And I said, okay. I said, what's that going to cost me and how is that going to work like? You know, they told me, and they put me in, they give me a choice of all these different, I don't know what they call it, writers, I suppose.
Who
you tell them the story and they're going to write the book.
Yeah.
And there was a guy down in Miami. That was about 3 hours away from us. And I said, look, this guy here, he was English, and he was writing for the Washington Post, the New York Times, but also the Sun and the Daily Mirror in the UK, like, you know. And I said, this one here, he'll understand, you know, the slang and different things. I said, so I picked this guy, and they put me in contact with him. And he said, look, we'll do this by Skype. He said, it's a lot cheaper. I said, no. I said, anything I do it right. I want to see the color of your eyes.
Yeah.
I said, I'll tell you the story. And so he said, okay, well, you'll have to come down to Miami.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, it'll take about a week.
Yeah.
I thought he was trying to put me off and just wanted to do it. I said, I don't care. I'll go down. So we drove down to Miami and we stayed there for a week. And, first of all, he said, stay in this place here. And I'm from Belfast, like, you know, it was £2,000 a night, this thing that to stay in this place. I said, are you joking me? Like, you know, so I find somewhere else. And even that was £200 a night.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I was in Miami. I didn't realize how more, we were living in Orlando. The difference in prices was unbelievable.
Yeah.
So he sent us down to this place, and on the Monday, like, you know, he said, I'll come over to you. I said, come over if you want. I said, but I'm not staying where you sent me to. I'm staying at this other place, and maybe it's not what you think, like, you know. He says, well, look, come over to me over here. And during that week before I went, I sent him 17,000 words of a background, like, you know.
Yeah.
And when I got there, he listen, we spent every day together, and he'd done the story, and he had about 2 weeks to then send me the first draft.
Wow.
And he sent me the first draft, and Mary read it. She goes, you better read this here, what this guy's put, because I'd spent, you know, I'd been in prison a few times, like, you know, and there was different, I didn't know, when I spoke to that guy, he had... he was a crafty bugger, and I didn't know it. He was a journalist, and he was getting stuff from me, but I didn't really know what I was sort of saying to him, like, you know, and he was putting me down alleyways. I wasn't clever enough for the guy, but when I got the first draft and she read it, she goes, whoa, you better read this here. And he had turned it into some sort of a gangster book, like, you know, I was never involved in anything with drugs or nothing like that there. As a kid, I was always fighting.
Mm.
And I went to prison half a dozen times for it. Always only fighting, nothing, never stealing, never drugs, nothing like that. Just always scrapping, like, you know. And this fella had listened to some of the stories. He was asking me stories, and he'd made this book. It was like one of these sort of gangster books, like, you know.
Yeah.
And I phoned him up, and I said, what's this? I said, I'll give you 17,000 words of a draft before I even met you, so you knew what my story was about, and it certainly wasn't about prison and stuff like that there, like, you know. I said, you completely missed the point. And he said, well, I said, leave it. I said, I'm going to write it myself.
Yeah.
And I phoned up this guy in Los Angeles who I originally went to, and I told him about this cowboy, what he'd done, like, you know.
Yeah.
And he says, well, don't worry, we're going to fix it. And it was all fancy talk, like, you know. I said, listen, don't give me none of that bullshit. I'll write the book myself.
Yeah.
I said, I don't know how to do it. I don't know. I said, but I can do better than the bollocks this fella's done, like,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So the next morning, I got up and I just started writing. Mm. And I just started typing on a Word document, like, mm-hmm, you know? Mm-hmm. And just carried on for weeks and weeks typing it out, saving everything. Wow. And I was always scared to make sure everything was saved.
Oh, man, that's the drama, like, isn't it? You're like, don't let me lose my words for me.
So I got it, and I'd done it all, and this company, they come back to me, and they said, how are you getting on with that? And I said, well, I'm up to about 56,000 words. And he goes, well, look, that's enough for a book.
Yeah.
I said, all right, well, he said, well, maybe we'll, he said, let us polish it off for you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I said, all right. I said, but you're not changing nothing.
Yeah.
I said, I want that. Whoever's reading that, the end user is going to know it's me that read that book, not someone else. So they took it off me, and they took about 1,000 words out.
Yeah.
And it was then that Mary said to me, listen, you get donating this, any monies off this to the homeless, but you've put nothing about the homeless in.
Mm.
So the story I was telling you about Dublin earlier on,
the
1,000 words they took out, I put it in back in again.
Just
about, yeah,
very good.
Just about the homeless and what it was like in Dublin and how I got back home and everything else, like, you know. So that was it. I wrote it, done it all myself, and I got in touch. There's a guy in Pat Mullen. He's an author. He's from Belfast, I think, originally. He's living down in Clifton, and one of Mary's cousins gave his number, and I phoned him up, and I said, listen, I want to get this book published. I don't know how quite to go about it, blah, blah, blah. And he put me in contact with these people in Argentina, these two sisters, actually, and they helped me sort of get it into a book form, and design the cover, and that was it. We just went straight to Amazon with it then, and
brilliant,
got it printed, like, you know.
Class. Yeah, that's a great story. You know,
it was a great learning curve, like, asked, you know, just, you know, trying to get commas where they should be, and you know, trying to get it right, like, you know, and you had to read it 3 or 4 times to see where the mistakes was, you know. But it was a good learning curve, and actually, I'm now just doing the research on another book at the moment, so I've got a bit of a bug for it, so when we get back to America, hopefully in December this year, I'll sit down and do another one, like, you know.
So, talk to me about this walk. Talk to me about the walk. Well, that's what's going to take you up to December, isn't it?
Yeah, we leave on Monday from Malinhead, and we're going to walk down to Cork, but it's 2,500 kilometres. I think as the crow flies, it's only probably 400 or 500 miles from there to there. But we're going to go in the Wild Atlantic Way, where you can drive all. We're going to walk it. And I suppose that come from, we always give ourselves challenges, myself and Mary. Like, you know, we're always looking for something different rather than sitting at home. As I say, if you give what I said earlier about giving yourself something to do, a target, I've always hit it, like, you know. And 2 years ago, we decided, Mary said to me, let's do the Camino. And I thought she wanted a dance. I hadn't got a clue what the Camino was. She explained. And I said, okay, let's go and do it. And literally 2 weeks later, we had 2 rucksacks, and away we went. We started off in France, went over the Pyrenees, and we walked. It was 900 kilometers to Santiago de Compostela, I think it's called.
Nice
anyway. Yeah. And when we got there, you know, we was a bit let down, like, you know. That took us a couple of months, that walk. We were walking about 25-30 kilometers a day.
Yeah.
And when we got to Santiago, it was a letdown, really. And so we'd met these other pilgrims. It's a pilgrimage. We wasn't doing it as a pilgrimage.
Yeah.
It was a challenge to us. I mean, we're Catholics and we go to mass every week and everything, but we didn't treat it as a pilgrimage.
Mm.
It was just really just that challenge. And when we got to Santiago, we said, well, look, let's carry on. And in the old days, they used to walk to Finisterre, which was another 100-odd kilometres, which before Christopher Columbus, that was the end of the world.
Oh, wow.
That's where they said Finisterre was always known as the end of the world.
Because
the water finished there and there was nowhere else. So we walked to there, and we, when we got to finish there, then it was a sense of achievement. We'd walked right across the whole length of Spain, like, you know. And that was great. We flew back home to Malta, and then one day we was in the pub there. We had a few pints, and I said to her, do you know them pilgrims? And I thought, that pilgrimage is 1,000 years old, like, you know. And I said, in them old days, them poor buggers had to walk back again.
They did, that's right.
So she goes, what do you get? I said, well, look, we got a bus and then we got a plane home. I said, let's go and do it again. but we'll walk back.
Yeah.
Okay. So what we'd done, we then walked from, I said, we'll change it. I don't want to walk the same walk as we'd done before. Yeah. So we started off from Lisbon, and we walked from Lisbon the whole length of Portugal.
What?
Up to Santiago in Spain. Then we walked across, back across the Camino, the opposite way, back over the Pyrenees, down into France, and then we walked up half of France up into Bordeaux. So that took us 3 months then, but I'd said to her at the start of it, we're going to go as pilgrims. She goes, what do you mean? We can afford to stay in any hotel we want to, like, you know, but what we... I said, we've got €30 a day between us.
Mm.
That's for food, drink, getting your head down. It's everything. Yeah. So we'd done it on a budget of €30 a day.
Class.
And we'd done it.
Yeah.
Until we got, once we came back over the Pyrenees, I mean, the snow was 2 foot deep and it was desperate, like, you know, but we come down across the Pyrenees into France, and we noticed the difference in prices right away from Portugal and Spain and France.
Yeah.
And there was no way we could do it on €30 a day. So that went out the window in France. But yeah, so that gave us the bug for walking.
Yeah.
So that year we'd done the Camino one way and another way.
Incredible.
Back in Croatia. And this year, like, you know, when we come, we had to leave America in June because our visa was up.
Yeah.
And said, well, look, we'll go and we've got a catamaran in Spain where we left it in Spain. Let's go and we'll go around the Med for 6 months and come back. That was the plan originally. Then when the virus come in, I said, well, look, everywhere's locked down. We're not going to get anywhere on the boat. What's the crack here? What are we going to do? And we come up with this idea. Well, let's go and do the Wild Atlantic Way. We've walked every other one of bugger's country. Let's go and walk our own country, like, you know.
Yeah.
So that's where the plan come for it. And then again with the homeless, we said, well, the proceeds will go straight to the homeless, like, you know.
Yeah.
That was the crack there.
So cool. So, I mean, you've mentioned one of the reasons for writing the book is to inspire young people.
Yeah. What I sort of hoping that some young, because I would have loved to pick that book up. I mean, we've had some fantastic, no negative reviews at all. Maybe people are just being nice and they don't say nothing, but we've had fantastic reviews from everyone. And I would have loved to read a book like this myself. I thought, if that guy can do that there, I can do that there.
Mm.
This is someone with no education, I suppose, but just a willingness to be able to, you know, as I say, if I put my mind to anything, and anyone can do the same, if you put your mind to something, you'll do it.
Mm.
But you just got to have that self-belief in yourself. And a lot of people, they haven't got the self-belief, or they haven't got confidence or whatever. Well, you got to break a few eggs to make an omelette. You got to make, you know, I've made more mistakes than anyone, like, you know, but I've learned from every mistake, sort of thing, whatever it's been.
Yeah.
I've sort of learned from it, or put it right, and we won't let that happen again. And I think if you have that belief, there's nothing can stop anyone. But you've got, I suppose, I don't know where the drive, whether it comes from that, whether being poor and you don't want to be poor, or you want to have money, or you want to have the nice things in life.
Yeah.
Unless you're inheriting it, you've got to go and get it, like, you know.
Totally.
I have a couple of other businesses with my daughters now. I have two daughters. And growing up, you know, we could afford to give them all what they needed and what they wanted. But unless they went and cleaned the car or cut the grass, they got nothing. They learned the value of a pound.
Yeah.
And, you know, you got to, I suppose my dad drove it into us. And some people, maybe you've got to find that drive yourself. If it hasn't been drilled into you, you've got to find that drive. You want to succeed, and you will succeed if you can. You know, you want it bad enough, and you'll go and do it. Like, you know,
absolutely, Leonard. So there's a couple of questions that I kind of ask every single guest. So these are kind of part of the show.
We kind of call them
the stock questions, and they're how we start to kind of land the plane of each episode. First one is maybe a bit of a random place to start, but out of everything so far, right, out of all your life experience, what would you describe as your greatest success or the most successful moment?
Probably starting up the company. Like, you know, we had three or four different companies, and then we had a group structure, and, you know, it was employing hundreds of people, you know, 20 odd million pound turnover at that time before the recession sort of come in, and building that business, I suppose that's probably the best achievement I could have had. Like, you know, come with a lot of responsibility, because I didn't realize you were building a sort of an animal that needed a lot of feeding.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Yeah.
And so, you know, one of the cleverer things you learn. I mean, at one time we used to be chasing turnover, you know, and thought that was great, but you copped yourself on there, like, you know, and it was really all about the net profit. And that's all, you know, we're really focused on now. And within the whole business, it's the net profit that we're really focused on. So as achievement, probably starting that business, it's going very, very strong today. You know, we're all over the sort of south of the UK. That's probably the biggest success. Like,
brilliant,
you know, and also actually seeing the people within the business grow themselves. Like, you know, there's guys, as I said earlier, who started on a shovel, who are now, you know, directors of the company, or contract managers within the business. They're all managers within the business, who just having a bit of belief in them, and them having a bit of belief themselves, and wow, this is unbelievable. Like, you know,
it's class. Flip side of that question then, like, what about the most challenging moment, and how were you able to overcome that?
The most challenging?
Yeah.
There wasn't one, there's been a million. Going back to the business side of things, we you know, at one time we hadn't got a pot to piss into, so you needed to find resources from different places, like money from different places. And at that time, you know, maybe the banks wouldn't give you, if you didn't have security or stuff to put down there, they wouldn't give you any money. And you think, well, I'm trying to grow the business, but I haven't got no money, sort of thing.
Yeah.
And there's a story in the book there about two guys there that I was building a hotel for them at Gatwick. And They were paying me at that time. They were bringing cash over. They had a quarry in Kenya, and they were bringing it, every month they'd pay us in cash, like, you know. And there's one stage there. There was a coup, and they couldn't get any cash out. And I spoke to them and said, look, you know, for months and months and months, we'd been getting all this cash, which was fantastic. They couldn't get anything out, but they had to stop work on the build on the hotel. And I said, look, we'll fund the hotel till you can get back going again. And they couldn't believe it, and we'd done it.
Yeah.
And after a few months, the governments in Kenya settled down. They got back, you know, back into the ways of the bringing cash back into the UK and whatever. And we built the hotel. And just before the end of it, I went to them. And the story's in the book there, actually. The principal guy, I went and asked him for some money. And I was cheeky enough. I asked him for $500,000.
Yeah.
I mean, you imagine this, like, you know. And at that time, we was building the PC. You've got PC World here.
Curry's.
Well, we were building their flagship place for them on the bottom of the M1 at Staples Corner.
Mm-hmm.
And he said to me, "Are you still?" I said, "Yeah, we're still building that now." He said, "Meet me there tomorrow morning." And this old boy, I'm there on the site, like, you know, I'm suited and booted. I always wear a suit in them days, like, you know. And your man got off a red double-decker bus right out in front of it. Like, you know, I'm standing waiting for him, and I can't believe he got off a bus, like,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
And he said, show me around this place. And we went inside. It's a massive big cavern, you know, of a shop it was going to be. It was their flagship place in the UK. And he said, what's your sort of plans, like, you know? And yeah, I told him. And he just pulled out an envelope, and he gave me a check for £500,000. And he goes, look, there's no contract, no nothing. He says, it's a handshake.
Wow.
I said, well, we've done it. That £500,000 was enabled me to start doing what I wanted to do. And over the years then, I paid him, in the next year I give him the £500,000 back.
Yeah.
But that was a massive big start for me. And, you know, so another time I go to him, I got £1 million, another time £250,000, £500,000. And this all over the period, I don't know, 10 or 15 years. Well, yeah, I'm still involved with him now. He died, but I paid him straight back.
Yeah.
We agreed sort of terms, whatever it was.
Yeah.
I pay a bit of interest on it. And that allowed me to bypass the banks.
Incredible.
And sort of build the business. So anyone, you know, you need to look. I mean, I was cheeky enough to ask him. If I didn't ask him, all that would have been gone, and I wouldn't have had that opportunity. So,
absolutely,
you know, ask. I mean, there was another guy there, Mansour. We built a property in London, and it was sold. It was on the front of the Daily Mirror and the Sun and all them papers.
Mm.
It was sold for about 30, 40 million at that time. It was the most dearest property in, I'm going back 25 years ago.
Yeah.
It was the dearest property in the UK. And he was an Iraqi guy. Come over to the UK flogging oil ink cartridges, like, you know, mm-hmm, made a lot of money at it, got into property. And we built this place for him.
Mm.
And he sold it to an Israeli diamond dealer.
My goodness.
For something like 30, 40 million pounds. Then, it's 20 years ago, like, you know.
Yeah.
And I said to him, Mansour, because I was going to my friend, the Kenyan guys.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to have all my eggs in one basket. And I said to Mansour about... He said, what are you looking for? I says, give me £500,000.
Yeah.
I says, I'm going to give you this interest back on that then.
Yeah.
And he said, come with me. And he took me into his office, and he had a table like this here, and it was a slate. It was like a tile. It was like £5,000 per square meter of these tiles. He goes, look, I want to put these in my properties. I don't what you're looking to build. I don't that doesn't it doesn't excite me.
I
want to build stuff with this here.
Yeah.
And I said, well, look, I'm not asking you to build it. I'm asking you to give me the money.
Yeah,
know?
Yeah.
But he you asked, and he said no. So that was it. But my point is, if you don't ask,
absolutely,
you're not going to get.
Absolutely.
And don't be shy at asking. Like, you know, you know, many a times there, we went to the bank, and in 2008 we had started another business, James Land Homes, and at that time I owed the bank £9 million at that time, but we had assets of over £11 million.
Mm.
And the bank got taken over probably about 3 or 4 months before by Lands Banky and Atlantic Bank. They took over, it was the Heritable Bank, and Lands Banky, this Atlantic Bank, took them over. And they was going bust, and they come to us and they said, well, you got £9 million. I said, hang on a minute, what are you fucking on about? You going bust, not me.
Yeah.
You know, I said, you're breaking the agreements we got. And anyway, they appointed insolvency practitioners, liquidators. So we ended up doing a deal with the bank that as long as they got their £9 million back,
mm-hmm,
we valued these lands and properties that we were going to build. We valued them at over £11 million. But this was in the recession.
Yeah.
But there was no flats or apartments. It was all big houses. It was all stock that we was intending to build. And the agreement was they got their £9 million back, and we kept the £2 million.
Yeah.
And we'd done it. We sold them all £11 million.
Wow.
And this was a big lesson, like, you know, they told us to bugger off. That's not what they told us. They told us to fuck off.
Yeah.
Yeah. I said, well, you know, I expect this on the streets of Belfast. I don't expect this here with a guy sitting across the table with me with a shirt and tie on.
Yeah.
These guys were sharks, like sharks, you know. They cut your legs off and throw you onto the bus at a drop of a hat.
Yeah.
I said, we had a deal with you.
Yeah.
You know, and he just told me to F off. You know,
crazy. Said,
no matter what that deal was, we've now got, the bank have now got this money in.
Yeah.
It's cost £2 million in our costs, liquidators' costs, and you're paying for it. Take us to court. What do you do? Like, you know, and that
crazy.
Was, I said, well, I'll never deal with a bank again.
Yeah.
That was 2008, 2009.
Wow.
And from that, we've as I say, I have a property development business with my daughter and I, the oldest daughter.
Yeah.
And we don't do any borrowing from any banks. We built it up slowly. I wouldn't borrow anything from a bank again, like, you know.
Incredible. Yeah, incredible.
So, I know it's a bit of a long-winded answer.
No,
to,
mate,
to,
it's,
to a question.
It's fascinating. Like, it's really fascinating. One of the actually, the second last question is just simply, if you could take anyone from Northern Ireland, dead or alive, out for a pint or out for a cup of coffee, who would you take?
Wow. Probably no one famous. I'm just celebrities and stuff like that. It's never impressed me.
Yeah.
I'd probably take my dad and my uncle Gus.
Awesome.
You know, Gus is still alive. I say my dad is dead. But I remember as a kid, they used to go up, you know, around the bars and sit and listen to the stories about when they were young.
Yeah.
I'm never going to get that back. And half the places they went are all gone anyway, like, you know. But sitting listening to them stories as a kid, and listening to my dad about, he was a seaman. He'd been around the world 3 or 4 times as a merchant seaman in his younger days. And I think that's where I sort of got the bug from.
Yeah.
You know, so I'd say if I could, you know, if you could have that time back, just as I remember sitting in the wee snugs in sort of, you know, McElhattan's or, you know, Madden's Bar or someone like that there. Mm. And just as a kid, you know, 11, 12, 13 year old, and your dad slip you a half a beer or whatever, you know, and it's sipping around, just listening to their stories.
Yeah.
To have that back again, so it wouldn't be a cup of tea, it'd be a pint with my Uncle Gus and my dad. Like,
it's awesome, awesome. Mm. Leonard, man, this is really unreal, honestly. Really, really enjoyed this. Final question we always ask everybody. If you could go back, let's say to like an 18-year-old version of yourself, you had a few minutes of 18-year-old Leonard's time, what sort of things would you say to him?
To myself, Jesus. I don't know. I think probably don't be so trusting. I've always been trusting of people. I've always believed that you get back what you give out.
Mm.
And perhaps I've been a bit too trusting in times. I don't care. I probably wouldn't change that in some ways.
Mm.
I'd rather keep the way I am. And sometimes that costs me, and whether that's financially or whether that's any other way at all, I'd probably say be a bit more careful that way and who you're trusting. I would say go and have a go. I'd say to anyone, have a go. You know, if you never have it, what are you going to lose, sort of thing, like, you know? I made so many mistakes, I think you just got to have a go at things and learn. Just learn from your mistakes.
Yeah.
I think that would be it, really.
Awesome, man. Leonard, that was class. And if you're listening and you want to pick up a copy of Leonard's book, Leonard's memoirs, effectively, title's Keeper Lit. You can find it on Amazon.
Yeah.
You can get it there. And if it's your first time listening to Best of Belfast, thanks for spending this time with myself and Leonard. Really, really appreciate it. And you can check out over 160, maybe even 170, not even sure where we're at, interviews, conversations with incredible local people, just like you've heard today from Leonard over at bestofbelfast.org. And other than that, Leonard, just got to say thank you for your time, man.
No problem.
Really enjoyed hearing your story. And class. Cheers.
Well, hopefully someone, young lad will get something from it, like, you know.
Totally. Awesome. See you soon.
Thank you.